In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to The Mentor, I'm Mark Boris. Jenny Child, welcome to The Mentor.
Thanks so much.
You nervous?
I'm so nervous. I never get nervous. My team is thinking it's hilarious because they're like, you never get nervous. Board meetings, whatever. Here I am, nervous. And funny enough, someone said to me, oh, that's great because you're going to learn. That means you're right in the learning zone. I was like, I hate when people say that.
Yeah, totally. Okay, let's unnerve you a little bit now, okay? So you're the CEO of Oraton. And by the way, I'm really interested and keen to talk about Oraton because Oraton's had a bit of a resurgence. Oraton was something that my mum would have had. Is GloMesh part of the Oraton group?
Mesh bags, yes.
Mesh bags. My mum had one. I remember, like, my mum today would be 90 years of age if she was still alive. But my mum had an Oraton bag, and it was a mesh bag. It was like silver, and she had it. That was like what she took out if she went to, I don't know, really formal function.
Right.
And I'm going back like 60 years. Yeah. I remember it. And that's what I think of. That's what I would have thought of a few years ago when it come to Oraton. That was just my thought process, okay? And as I recall, the Lane family owned Oraton.
Yes, that's right.
I don't know the boys. I know the two boys. In fact, they were original investors in one of my businesses many, many years ago. And we both, they don't anymore, but we used to have a property not far from each other up in Byron Bay area. They're back down in the Southern Highlands. And it's a bit of a good story. They sold it to a fund, as I recall.
Not exactly, but
tell me what happened with it.
I can take you through that history. Yeah, I mean, you've got a good handle, I think, on the history that a lot of people know, which is three generations of a family, the Lane family. Started in 1938, so we're 85 years old.
And wow, 85 years old.
85-year-old Australian brand.
I want to know. So it's always been an Australian brand?
Yes.
Always?
Always been an Australian brand and still is today. And there's so much goodwill for the brand because of that. I actually meet people and it's almost like, we're fighting for you. We love it. We love the resurgence. And it's like, where does that come from? It's very ingrained in people's psyche as this thing that they're proud of.
Yeah. It was a luxury bag.
That's right.
You know, you didn't have one of these if you were doing it tough. I mean, not that we were wealthy enough, but this the one thing my mum had that was luxury in her life.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really important thing for her. She was very, very proud of this bag, and she would go to a ball, I don't know, once every, it would like be a Greek wedding which we'd hold, or the Greek young matron's ball we would hold, they would hold at the, in those days, the Wentworth Hotel.
Yes.
And if we had a cousin or something, or I had to go and partner someone, we would go. Or a wedding, a lot of those times, the Greek weddings were huge. And sometimes the really fancy ones got held at the Wentworth Hotel. That's when you took the mum would take the Oraton bag out.
And did she keep it in the box and keep it
100%.
Yes.
Like, it was in a special part of her wardrobe. That was it. That was her big luxury item.
Yeah.
Her only luxury item. Mum didn't have, she had some pearls too, but I don't know if, but they weren't like, you know, South Sea pearls. That was, you know, I don't know. But her mum's pearls and her Oraton bag were the two flash things that she had in her life.
That's right. And that was the story for so many people for decades when that mesh bag was really the business and the brand. And that changed as handbags for women changed. I think Oraton evolved with it and it started to be more of an everyday bag that you wore more often than that special occasion. But I think to me, that's why I joined. is part of what I recognized was that ubiquitous love, that really positive memory that every single person I met, whether it was about your mom or your, you know, your grandmother or yourself, there was this story that was basically what the brand is.
Yeah, and this
ubiquitous
history.
Love, yes.
What happened? So the family, who did they sell it to? Because I remember they sold it and they made a lot of money. That's all I remember. And the two boys, I think it's only two boys. There's two brothers, isn't there?
Two brothers, yes. Yeah. That were part of the business.
They were, yeah. Who did they sell to?
So the story, I'll take you back just a little bit in terms of what happened on the journey. And when I first started, it was really important to me to understand the history. I love history.
Me
I think
too.
It gives you perspective. And one of the things I learned at McKinsey was the importance of era analysis, like frame the eras of a company so that you actually know what you have, what strengths you have to pull from and what the course of the market conditions that the business was playing and how that factored into the performance of the business, which is always important. So I kind of laid that out for myself and, you know, going back through those eras, starting with, you know, the 50s and the 60s and even part of the 70s where the mesh bag was the cash cow. I mean, that was the brand and the business. In the 70s, Robert Lane, who was running the business at that time, got the business into leather, which then framed the next decades.
As in leather bags.
Leather bags. You know, knowing that everyone had a mesh bag, as you described, there's only so much room to expand, especially if you're a domestic
brand. You're not
going to
have 10.
You can't have 10.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, I guess, but you'd have to, you know, really be obsessed with the bag. So once the leather handbag became the frame for what the business was, there was also then this growth thinking around, I call them rented brands, but how do we use the group structure of Oraton to look into other areas of retail that could also be part of the model and what we do? Because at that point, Oraton had its own stores, knew how to run stores in this country. And other brands like Ralph Lauren that wanted to come here sought Oraton out as a partner. So for a period of time, that brand in particular was very profitable for the group structure. And I think naturally you take your eye off the ball in terms of your core product of your Oraton designed products, how good they are, how relevant they are. And there was some slippage there. And so when Ralph Lauren pulled their license back, in 2012, I think it was, there was a period of time where Oraton was not really sure how it was going to maintain its relevance with consumers, lost a lot of credibility, as you said, with people who thought it was their mother's brand, but not relevant for them. And then in 2017-18, there was administration, and that's when Will Vickers bought the brand.
Oh, so Will runs a fund.
Yes.
Yeah. So
he runs Caledonia.
Caledonia. So, which is a very big fund. So, Caledonia bought the Oraton brand.
Actually, Will personally.
Oh, Will.
So it's not. Yeah, it's not owned by Caledonia, which was also part of the value proposition for me, coming into a structure and a company that had access to capital, but wasn't this massive governance structure of being owned by a fund.
Right. Okay. So Will, the Vickers family owned it.
Yes,
effectively.
Correct.
So, but if I could just go back a step, you just mentioned your experience at McKinsey. So just in relation to you, because that's sort of fairly important when it comes to your skill base, and that skill base then gets incorporated into the business. But like, just take me through your background in terms of McKinsey or even prior to that.
I think McKinsey is a good place to start. I was there for 15 years. So it really framed most of my professional life.
So American?
American,
yep.
Yes. So I grew up in the Midwest.
Yep.
I'm from Ohio.
Wow.
And
I've had some experience. It's an unusual place.
Yes.
For anybody who hasn't been there, I was had a business in Chicago and I was out of Lake Zurich where our campus was and, my God, different people.
And it could get cold there.
Oh, that's my God. Well, I actually got stuck there this time of the year, February, in 10 years ago, but I got stuck there in a snowstorm. Oh, my God. We hit the road really fast to get back into Chicago, the city, and I went to bed that night, woke up in the middle of the night, turned the TV on, and there was people actually dying on the road, like just trapped in their cars.
Yeah, that's scary.
Fully scary. And I got stuck in Chicago then for a week because the airport, everything closed down.
Yeah.
It's pretty radical.
Yeah, it's radical.
It's
I went to school in Chicago.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, they used to run the – this shuttle, when it would get so cold, you'd walk outside and all, like everything freezes, like you're not, like all the fluid on your face freezes. It was so dangerous to be outside. So in order to get to class, they would run these shuttles to pick people up. And
how does that shape you, like in terms of as a kid? And does that sort of have any impact on you as an adult, living that life?
Well,
living in those environments, because it's a very conservative place. Like people are so conservative.
It's not flash. I mean, I came from.
I know.
I'm saying it in a way that I try not to be disparaging. I actually spend a lot of my younger years not being proud of where I was from.
Yeah.
And I think that's because as I started to see the world, even being in Chicago from Ohio, you know, see parts of the world and realizing that you came from a place that was very salt of the earth and basic in a way, right?
We didn't love the hockey, you love the NFL.
Yeah, love sports. I mean, I grew up with, you know, the whistle on a Saturday morning of the and whatever game was on, college football, and dad having that on the TV. That was how I grew up. So very humble beginnings and not access to all the things that I obviously have access to now.
Check yourself at the door too, by the way. Like, hey, who the hell do you think you are? From the Midwest, so like, just don't behave like you're from New York or LA.
Yeah, which isn't that dissimilar from the culture here, right?
Totally.
This whole tall poppy idea.
Check yourself at the door.
Let's all just be part of the same community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very community based growing up. You know, the football game on Friday night was the big entertainment, and we all went, had a good time.
Religion.
And it
church
100% shaped me. To answer your question, I mean, 100% was something that I wasn't really proud to talk about. But then as I got older and more mature, and I thought, what did that actually teach me that got me here? It's that sense of community and how important it is. It's the, hey, you know, be kind to your neighbors because you never know when you need them. It's just that sense of being able to go on the front lines of the business that we have now, right, into the stores and talking to the retail teams and really understanding who they are as people. Not just they're an employee of the, but like who they are.
As culture.
Yeah.
Culturally.
Exactly.
So, but you wouldn't have known that though when you were, when Vickers like approached you. Well, we'll get back to that. But what I want to know is, did you know what Sydney was like, or Australia was like, I should say, relative to what your growing up background was like?
No idea.
No idea.
No idea when I moved here. No, I moved here cold. I was with McKinsey. And I just made partner in the U.S., so I'd spent, you know, 7 years building my career. And I had a client from Houston who was my favorite client. He was, again, sort of salt-of-the-earth guy, worked in a trash company for 40 years and was retiring. And he had gone from literally dumping cans on the back of a truck to running the entire commercial part of the business. So it was a very successful track record, really great guy. I had served him for 7-ish years of my time at McKinsey, pretty much the whole time. And he said, I'm doing this big move. I'm moving to Melbourne, taking this job at a similar company. And I know you made partner. You're not doing anything. Come over and help me.
As a McKinsey
partner.
Yeah.
To run the project with him. And I was like, sure, why not? Knew nothing really about Australia.
Yeah, so
and I got a lot of backlash from my friends and family about it.
Could you just sort of advise our audience on who McKinsey is? So, by the way, like not a lot of people know who Boss Consulting are or McKinsey or those sorts of organizations. Like, what are they? Why do clients engage with them? And what type of clients engage with them?
I had to explain McKinsey when I started at Oreton to the team because a lot of them didn't really understand where I'd come from either. And I described it as essentially like a Navy SEAL SWAT team to solve problems. So you get dropped into companies. It might not be an industry you're an expert in, but as a generalist consultant, especially in your early days, you get brought in to solve a really hard problem. And then the benefit, I can see that now, obviously, as an executive and an operator, the benefit you get in that position is you also have another team that are external that you can bring in and then say now they're gone to give you something that your team just were embarrassed to give you or wouldn't have got pushed it that far. And then it's all about, does the team actually own that answer? So all the criticism that you hear about consultants is, sure, they gave us a great answer, but no one believed in it. No one liked the idea in the first place. And so it sort of sat on a shelf. So that bridge between great problem solving and actually getting shit done is then the linkage that now I kind of sit at that intersection all the time. But that's why McKinsey gets brought in. It's to, you know, solve really hard problems and do it in a way that doesn't sort of take the team down either from an ego point of view or from a time capacity point of view.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting bringing experts, whether they come from McKinsey or some other, one of the other places, there's a few of them sort of popped up these days, but it's very interesting because I've used them in the past. So where it becomes useful is that they do a report to the board, for example, that's independent. Therefore, it's not biased. It's always difficult to internalize an inquiry because there's always either allegations of bias or prejudice, one of the two, or both. And therefore, when you go to execute on the final outcome, it looks like you're executing on a bias or a prejudice, which doesn't get people don't buy into it. If you bring in a third party expert, apart from being likely, if they're skilled, like organisations like McKinsey, apart from them being skilled and therefore finding things out that you may never have found out, the outcome is usually something that the experts told us to do it, and that's what we engage them for, and we, the board, now have an obligation to execute on that.
Yeah.
And therefore it's not you doing it, it's someone else sort of telling you you should do it. And it's a bloody good, I think it's a great leveller, like whether it's McKinsey or someone else, doesn't matter, but bringing in experts to dig around, they might find out something you would never find out because people withhold.
Yes.
Because they're protecting or themselves or somebody else. But allows you then to run the process. Once it's done and the report's done, the recommendations are there, you can then execute because you are really executing without bias or prejudice, your own particular bias or prejudice. It might be exactly the same outcome that you thought was going to happen anyway. It doesn't matter. But it's independent.
Yeah, the mechanism works, right?
Yeah, totally.
Because of that independence. And you do get that tear down perspective. It's like someone can come in without any sort of agenda and actually say, this is actually what's happening. This is the company that you have, not the company you want to have or you think you have. It's actually the one you have. And that's actually part of what we did when I first started. I took those tools and I said, let's do that here.
Did you do that with the waste company or did you do that with Oriton?
With Oriton.
So yeah, were you Oriton. First engaged at Oriton as a consultant?
No.
So take me through the process. How did it happen?
So I got introduced to Will and I thought
off another job?
No, I was just actually running the consumer retail practice. So it wasn't rare or uncommon for me to have someone in my network say, oh, I've got a friend or someone I know who's looking for some advice. And at that time, you know, the COVID situation and consumer trend, everything was just thrown up in the air. So just knowing how to navigate that, there was lots of work that the firm was doing to put thought leadership out there to say, this is what we see happening with consumers and what we see happening with the economy. And so I got introduced sort of in that vein to Will.
But like at a network type thing or?
No, just a mutual acquaintance and friend that we both had. He called me and said, I've got a friend who owns a retail business and, you know, he's thinking about what the strategy should be. And I think you guys could bounce some ideas off each other.
Well, because Will doesn't strike me as a retailer, to be honest with you, especially when it comes to women's bags and things like that. I mean, he's a hard-nosed fund manager looking for returns.
He's not an operator either,
no,
right?
No, like,
he's
not a retailer, he doesn't run business
he's not an
either.
Operator. That's right,
and,
exactly.
And so I guess – because, I mean, people would be listening to this would be saying to themselves, well, how did she network into Will's world? And that sounds interesting, Will's world. But how did she network into Will Vick's world? Or was there no network? It was just a chance meeting?
It was a bit of a chance meeting. I mean, I do believe that he had already made up his mind that the next era, the type of leadership team he wanted in the business. And so he was probably thinking a lot about that at the time we met. In fact, I know he was. And I was meeting him initially under the guise, and I didn't prep that much for it. I mean, I sort of went in blind of knowing even who Will Vickers was, frankly, until maybe the day before. And I was like, oh, well, is he going to be, you know, the New York investment banker or finance guy that I am used to? Like, is he going to be a real kind of asshole? Or, you know, how is this going to go? And I just kind of had my thoughts. I did a little bit of research. I knew Oriton as a brand because I covered consumer retail and I've always been interested in fashion. So from the day I landed in Australia, which at that point was 7-ish years before, I'd asked friends just casually, so what are the great brands here? What are the great Australian designers I should be thinking about? And usually it came up as a mention, not really you're going to shop there, but it was
R.M. Williams. It's not R.M.
Williams. Well, it wasn't Scanlan and it wasn't, you know, Camille and Mark and you know, brands where I would go and get my wardrobe for McKinsey Life. And at that time, I think it had just introduced clothes anyway. So it was really a handbag brand, but it did get a mention. And so it was on my radar and I had seen also the news about the financial situation. And so it's loosely on my radar, but I did a little diligence and then went to the Caledonia offices, which were a street away from McKinsey offices. So I just walked around the block and went into this fishbowl office in the middle of Caledonia and waited for Will to come in. He sat down and super casual guy looking to have a conversation, which is what we had. And that from there on, you know, we proceeded to then have conversations that were more serious about a role that he was looking to fill. And the conversation went from there. But the first meeting was very almost businesslike and set up through a friend, and I didn't really think much of it.
So the first meeting wasn't, you didn't think it was supposed to be an interview, but did it turn out to be an interview? How do you deal with that?
I think for me, it was just another meeting in my day. At the time, it was just another meeting in my day where I wanted to be able to be useful in, you know, bouncing off ideas and really understanding the situation. I did at one point in the meeting, it was probably early on, think what you just said earlier, which was, why the hell did you buy this? I did. And I asked him, I just sort of like leaned over the table and I was like, Will, why did you buy this asset? Like, what is it?
What did he say? Oh, I'm dying to know.
He leaned back a little bit in his chair and said, you know, I don't know. Literally said, I don't know. And I thought, okay, that's a curious response. Okay, let's talk more about it. We sort of dug into it. And of course, you know, he bought it for really sound reasons, which then resonated with me as well. But yeah, the interaction was one that I think left me really curious about who he was and why he had this asset. I knew he didn't know retail and he wasn't an operator. He was an investor. And so that led to a bunch of conversations about the potential of this brand that had kind of been this latent asset that you look at it and you're like, there's gold there. There's such love and goodwill in this brand. And if we can reignite that, it's got a whole future ahead of it.
It's funny because I was when you were saying that, when you said latent brand, the same sort of happened for R.M. Williams, the bootmakers and apparel and Dry as a Bone, those sorts of brands, which have sort of been more recently rescued, more recently over the last few years, have been rescued by people like Will, wealthy individuals, and they're actually all doing very well now. And apart from the other brands you mentioned, which are the more of the fashion brands, like you said Camilla and Mark, but like those sorts of Australian brands that are well known, they're doing well overseas. But those iconic brands that you're talking about, like in Oriton, they did get rescued by a number of people when I think about it, and most of them are doing pretty well because they just need to be put some life back into them, which is I find quite interesting, and that no one else really recognises.
Right.
One of which the people didn't recognise is me. I'm pretty pissed off with myself that I didn't actually think about this, but good on Will for doing that. A lot of people would be listening to this, Jenny, and they'd be saying to themselves that what they say to themselves, because these people tell me this stuff. They say, "Oh my God, I've got my business I'm running, or I've got my profession I'm doing, and I go to seminars and I, you know, upskill, PD days, professional development days. I go to industry events to see who's winning awards and stuff like that. And every now and then someone reaches out to me on LinkedIn or something like that and says, oh, I like what you're saying or doing. Could we have a meeting, just a coffee, catch up? Mm-hmm. And they say, and loads of people say to themselves, say to me, I don't know whether I'm wasting my time or not, because I've got so many other things to do in my job. My job, I could be working 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, and still not get everything completed, which I'd imagine would be the case for someone working at McKinsey's. But then again,
yeah, no time.
They say, I've got no time. Craig, so do I say when someone like Will reaches out to me, I mean, how do I work out the priority list of who I should attend or where I should attend to, or is this a bit of a luck game?
I don't think there's a recipe to it. I think for me, having something clear that you're dedicated to, that's your personal strategy related to your career, clearly important. I think there's a lot of people that I mentor and coach and see, especially young women who don't have that. And so all my work with them is, what is that 3-year goal? What is that 5-year goal? How do you really shape something that you're moving towards? But if you're not open and opportunistic then about opportunities that you could never foresee, then what are you doing? Like, that's not a way to live life. And so opening yourself to people you find interesting or have something curious that could contribute to how good you are as a leader or a human being, I mean, that's what life's about. So I think it's so important to stay open to that.
Okay, before I go back, I'll just put a question to you. So got a deadline. Deadline's at the end of February. We as a team are 2/3 of the way through getting the deadline work complete. We'll probably make it. But like, it's intense. I'm the leader. Let's say it's you. You're the leader of the team. You might be the proprietor of the business as well. It could be a deadline in relation to the business. Then 4 or 5 people reach out to you. Which ones? Just have a coffee, catch up.
Do you prioritize?
What do you do?
I definitely think there's periods of time you'd have the same thing where your head's down. You're like, this is a period of time where I just, external influences, like I have to stay really focused. Typically for me, those are pretty short periods of time. When I'm then in the prioritization mode, I mean, there's obviously links to the core nature of the business and things that could enhance what we're doing that make the list.
What about you personally though?
Personally.
How it's going to help me personally. I don't mean, what can I learn from this individual? Is that important?
Absolutely. I have that filter on all the time. I mean, I was like, what can I learn from Mark? I mean, how will this experience shape me and make me a better person and a better leader and all of those things, right? Partly just being nervous, as we talked about at the beginning, is like, okay, well, I'm probably going to learn something about myself that I'm either good at or need to work on, or something from Mark. I've listened now to a ton of your podcasts and I've picked up lots of things that otherwise I wouldn't have. So I think the curiosity of what you can learn from experiences and people is top on my list.
Curiosity. I love it.
Absolutely.
Because that drives me. I mean, I do these podcasts.
Clearly it drives me.
But it does, because I'm sitting here talking to someone. I don't even read the brief before you come in, to be honest. The team sets it all up. I quickly, McKinsey, Will Vicker's name, then Oraton, I thought of the Lane Boys. And then I think, wow, this is going to be a really good conversation for me because I'm going to learn something from you. That's why I do this, because I'm curious as to what I can learn. So if we're just talking to now our audience, people who are in business, the curiosity factor, you're successful and it's like there's a lot of ladders and snakes to get there. You're up and down, eventually you're up there. And that's about consistency and, you know, work ethic and all that other stuff. But how important is the curiosity factor in your success? How important has it been?
Critically important. I don't even try. It's just part of how I'm wired. The thing that I was most curious about when I first started was, what's this whole fashion thing about? What's the X factor in fashion? And sort of digging into that, I think, has then paved my first 2.5 years at Oraton in a very different way than I would have led otherwise. I mean, I was a commercial beast. Like, that was what I was trained to do.
Analytics. Very analytical.
I could tear down the P&L. I could like diagnose the business and what do we have today and what do we want to be and build the strategy. But if I had just stayed in that place, I would have been a miserable failure. And I probably still think some days that I am a miserable failure, by the way. But being really curious about why does fashion matter? Like, what? Like, is this a frivolous, superficial thing? Like, it's super vain.
It's a good call. What is it?
You know, what is it? What is it? And then you start learning things, right, that are really critically important, which is actually great brands, fashion or not, but great brands create the fabric for culture. Like, they are deeply important. And fashion is deeply primal. Like, it's an expression of people's individuality and themselves in a way that has made it a massive industry financially, but also has kept it around for so long.
Because there must be something in it. Because it's still here.
And it's massive.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the richest person in the world. Like, he is in fashion.
Yeah, totally, totally. So,
So these are the discoveries that, without actually being curious from the very first, you know, time I laid foot in the building, I would have just missed, and I would have then gone down that path of the classic consultant coming in and, you know, thinking about costs and ripping things out and looking at profit and so on and so forth. But there's a real X factor to be respected and cared for in our business and businesses like ours, which has to do with creativity, which is another whole area of I had never contemplated how important creative forces, sort of that magic fairy dust that you sprinkle throughout the value chain of our business, how important that was and how to strike a balance between commerciality and creativity. Whole new territory for me.
I'm going to go to the break. When I come back for the break, I actually want to talk about the creativity piece. I actually want to know how you feel today, the girl from the Midwest who's now involved in high stakes fashion, like, hello. I mean, the people who used to work for me, there was about 100 odd people over there, and you would know what I mean when I say Lake Zurich. A lot of people don't, but it's a pretty sort of, you know, everyone's got a sign out the front with their name on the front of where the letterbox is and their number of their place in the street and everything like that, and it's not fashion conscious. And then the blokes I used to know used to wear their jeans up to here, but they had a belt and a pair of runners on, and penguin T-shirt with a collar on. I'm not knocking them, but that was what I noticed.
That's a way of life.
Yeah, it's a way of life. But here you are at the center of a business that is about fashion. And I want to talk about the difference between fashion, classics, creativity, how far to go, how far not to go, and also the culture that is associated with your brand. I noticed you've got in front of you an Oraton bag, and I want to talk – I mean, that's – for a person from McKinsey who's goes down statistics and analytics, like – what the fuck? Like, this is totally out there for me to see something like that, and I want you to talk about the bag. I want you to talk about that bag.
Yeah,
and I want you to tell me about that bag.
Happy to.
And why are you pitching in front of the camera? Because I'm very happy to put it in front of the camera because it is, to me, it looks like a beautiful bag. But I want you to break it down, the leather, the color, the work, the stitching, everything. So let's go to the break. Come straight back.
Great.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Break. I'm here with Jenny Child. She's the CEO of a great Australian brand, Oraton, as revitalized by the Vickers family. Well done. Good luck. And, you know, we just talked through your journey into this brand. Let's first and foremost, please tell me how we went from the mesh bag to when you first entered Oraton. What were they selling? What was the deal? What were the, I don't want to call them SKUs, but like,
yeah.
Were they fashion, clothes, handbags, hats? What were they doing?
Huge change from the origins of actually the original business from Boyd Lane, and what he started was a textile importer. So not even finished good. It wasn't until I think 51 when the first manufactured little bedazzled mesh compact was sold.
It was very small too, wasn't it?
Very small. It was a little circular compact. We have one in our cases when you first walk in our office.
Like a little.
Just to pay homage to it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But, really special products that then merged into the mesh bag. And that was really several decades of time. And then Robert Lane, who son of Boyd, who was running the business, and he ran the business for 40 years of his life, a long time. And he realized, he told me this story. I met him a few times, and every time I met him, I learned something. He said he and his wife went to a house party, and back in the 70s, I think this was the early 70s, when you went to a house party in Australia, there was one room designated as like the coat bag room.
Yeah.
So you walked in, and he said he got there late, so everyone was already there. They opened the door to the designated bedroom, and there was a sea of mesh. So the whole bed was covered in mesh. And it was at that moment that he realized that the penetration of mesh bags was this, where do we go from here? We've got to get into something else.
Oversaturated.
Oversaturated. And so he said, well, obviously that's still our heartland, but how are we going to innovate that? And he told the story that he and his wife got on a plane the next week and went to Italy and sourced the first leathers and leather bags for the business. And so he got the business into leather bags. And if I then fast forward to not drone on the story to where we are now, handbags is still the heartland. Like, we are known to be a handbag business. We still are today from a financial teardown point of view. But since then, we've added clothing into and apparel into the mix. And that's been a huge strategic move. Sophie Holt, who is our creative director, came from Country Road. And part of her priority was her number one priority for the first few years before I was started was make the product look good again. Actually make the product relevant to consumers and women. And part of doing that in her mind was bringing in apparel. And as I then studied, what does that mean and why apparel and how is it going? Apparel for women is a category that we buy more frequently and there's lower consideration.
Apparel meaning bags.
Apparel meaning clothes.
Clothes, okay.
Clothes. So right. This vest that I'm wearing. So this is something that, you know, we're constantly thinking, shopping, not everyone. It's obviously grades of that. But a lot of women are bringing new pieces of apparel into their wardrobe at a higher frequency than you would a bag. This spins on a slower plate, if you will. So bags generally more considered, lower frequency. And so the combination of those two categories for the business is amazing. It just gives us more contact with consumers, more relevance in their life by having that category. So that's really what the brand is today. We also have a jewelry category. So just building out that accessories, you know, this being an accessory, jewelry is an accessory. That's a space that seemed really easy for us to play in. And we'd always dabbled in it. So we're playing in it in a more significant way.
So in terms of, can you just take me through the fashion versus classics? So there's a big difference between the two. I mean, maybe some of the cheaper brands are more, that's probably not right. More fashionable, but more fashion is sort of looks like more disposable to me.
You think of more trendy. You're thinking
trendy.
It's more trendy.
Fashion that trends. Yeah, it could be something that's on the back of the bus, being advertised on the back of the bus, and it's in front of you. Like, there's, I won't say the name of the brand, but I see it every day when I'm driving my car.
I think I know who you're talking
about. Yeah, and by the way, they've killed it.
Killed it.
Like, I thought to myself, who is this brand?
I know.
They're appealing to young women, probably 20 to 30, something like that. And
My son, who's 7, recited it the other day because we're always driving together to school, and he said the brand, name of the brand, and I thought, back of the bus.
Yeah, that's on the back of the bus. And I read recently that they either sold it or bought investors in for a large amount of money. I didn't realize they are very popular. They do very well. That to me is like the fashion thing. Like, it's not expensive. It's a thing you can turn over every couple of months. It doesn't matter if you throw it out. Whereas classic things like a handbag like that, and perhaps pearls or whatever those case may be, or a vest that like you're wearing, it's the sort of thing you can wear.
For a really long time.
Yeah, for next year. Or you can put it away. It's probably more expensive. It's sort of more an investment to some extent. And it also doesn't attach to every cohort. Like, maybe younger people don't buy because it's maybe outside their budget. How does Oriton break down, or who is your audience? Who's Oriton's audience then? Is it more the classic, or?
And how do we balance that? It's at the core of the strategy of what we create and the design process that we go through, which is, it has a lot of structure that I've put in place, but the creative veins were sort of already there. And we do think about it in terms of how the longevity of product, both from a quality, how it's made, the craftsmanship behind it, both design and production, and also the style. Because part of you wanting to wear this bag, not you, but someone wanting to wear this bag 10 years from now, maybe.
No.
10 years from now is that it lasts from a design point of view. It's still relevant.
In terms of quality.
Quality and style.
And look.
And
okay.
Style. Yeah, right, the style. Okay. So you know, a lot of women don't want to be walking around in things that look outdated and not fresh and modern.
So that means you've got to give it a classic look. Is that what we're talking about, classic look?
I think the style of what we put out, classic is, I guess, one way to describe it. But, it's more timeless in that it still has the features of being modern, and that might be the color of the leather or some of the features, but it's not stuff that's trendy, that's going to be out of fashion in a year
next
from
year.
Now.
Yep.
That's right. So I don't think we participate in a lot of what we create in that trend space. Our team is not oriented that way. It's not part of what we stand for as a brand. I mean, this is about fashion that stays with you, that they're investment pieces that you keep and you work back with other things in your wardrobe. And that is also a responsible part of fashion. I mean, I think what we've all watched happen is the destruction that fashion and fast fashion in particular has led us to from a climate point of view, from a waste point of view. And we're not participating in that. We don't want to participate in that. So we're actually now inventing ways to participate in the circular fashion economy, which is about reselling your product when you've worn it a few times or for a few years and you want something fresh and new. There's a way to actually pass it on and keep it having a life with someone else. There's also then the rental component of fashion, which is really interesting. And how do we then embed that in our model? There's been some models in the world, and Rent the Runway is a good one in New York that I've watched for a long time, and they've probably not got it perfectly right. But there's an element of what that offers an individual about how to keep their closet fresh and invest in pieces they want to keep but still wear things that they might want to wear once, get a lot of joy out of, and then that's it. So working that into the model is part of our future.
So I actually want to talk about that in a second because that's really interesting to me. I used to, when I used to work in law firm, used to look after a lot of rag traders who are in the fashion industry. And what they used to tend to do is to go off to Italy, and they'd find out what the latest things were, Gucci, Bucci, whatever, and they'd bring it back to Australia. And then when they bring it through, I remember they used to bring through customs, they used to have to cut a tag or cut something off so you couldn't resell it. But they would just basically reproduce that in Australia, and that would be this year's fashion. This would be this year's items. In terms of how it gets designed at Oriton, do you do that? Do you lean on what Valentino's doing or Gucci's doing or what all the other brands are doing? How much do you lean on those? I mean, how much different style can anyone invent, or has it already been invented or been designed?
I think that's why you see this flywheel of fashion happening, right, where styles, whether it be the style of jeans coming back after 10 years or a period of time. So I think there is a bit of a circular nature to different styles that are hot. Again, that's probably some of the trend thing going on as well. And I think it'd be silly to say that fashion is an ecosystem that feeds off of itself, whether that be colors of the season. You know, fashion weeks are agenda-setting moments where, you know, whether that be Milan or Paris or New York, where there is an imprint that everyone's kind of paying attention to that is culturally relevant for some reason. Maybe it's established by one of the big brands or one of the big designers, but that everyone's then saying, okay, well, how do we interpret that and what does that mean to us? So I do think that's part of just being in fashion. What we've spent a lot of time crystallizing, which is a really interesting, you talked about R.M. Williams. If you go back to the discipline that an Australian, very insular brand who's had a lot of success over the decades, but now has to compete on a whole different scale. I think the discipline that brands have had to have that are Australian in defining who we are and what we stand for is just lower than you had to have if you were in the US or the UK and fighting for your life every day for the whole time that you existed. And so we've actually gone through a process to really crystallize what we call the signifiers, which is our own handwriting as a brand.
The main elements of your brand.
Yeah, things that we've always stood for from a style, specifically from a style point of view, that then threads through the product and everything we put out so that there's something quite unique that sure, there's an imprint of what's happening in the fashion world, but then there's this very clear handwriting that everyone can go back to and say, oh yeah, that's an Origin bag. I can see it just in the stitching or in the way the hardware is formed and the things that Origin stands for. I can see it and I know it even without having to say it.
So you got your set of principles in terms of the design.
That's right.
That it's immediately recognizable. So that if, because I like the idea of the circular economy process. In other words, you can resell it or rent it or whatever the case may be, so that we're not just buying stuff and throwing it out or buying stuff and just hoarding it. Not doing anything.
That's
with
right.
It. I mean, I like this, but you're saying to me that the people who might rent or the people who might buy it would immediately recognize these hallmarks of the Origin brand.
That's right. The signifiers, as we say, that.
Could you explain one or two of them to me? What, like, for example, is it gold? I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't have a clue. But
yeah. So, well, one of the things that the team, especially as it relates to bags, because there's different signifiers for the yep. different categories. So the way that we think about, first of all, the design is form and function is really important. So we get punished heavily, and we've noticed this over time, when the functionality of the bag isn't there. And so things like having clips where I can take the strap off, put a different strap on, you know, have different ways to wear it that make it really versatile, have a pocket where I can slip something in without having to open the bag. So the function of the bag is really part of the signifiers broadly that we work on. There's other things around nautical, for instance, one of our signifiers. There's a lot of inspiration taken from knots and hardware on boats and ships that then work their way back into how we might form the hardware piece for one of our bags. So that's what I mean by signifiers, and there's just a few so that it doesn't also overwhelm the consumer and they can see the pattern.
Good. When you go back to, I know I don't want to keep hitting back on this, on the mesh bag, but just a feeling, I could be 100% wrong, but there seems to be a, in the signifiers, one of the outcomes is practicality. So the mesh bag was just big enough to hold certain things that a woman may need to use at the event she was going to. It wasn't too big, but it wasn't too small. My mum's one was sort of more elongated, as I remember. It was a bit more longer, but mum used to always. I remember mum used to, because I was a kid. I used to always hang out with mum and said, "What she's doing?" She would, before she was going out. It was exciting to me. We wouldn't be going out; we'd be staying home. But like, she used to put things in, like, and she'd say, "I'm going to put my lippy in here," and she'd put all the different things in there. So it was very practical.
I knew you were going to say
lippy. Yeah, very practical, and so practicality. You just hit on something quite interesting. Having that pocket on the outside there, but it's obviously secure. But practicality, is that a big issue for Origin consumers in relation to what they expect from the brand every time?
Yes. Yes.
And that's very Aussie.
It is. Is it? It is very Aussie.
I think it is, but I might be making a big error here, but I think it is.
It is. It's funny that you say that, because we're doing a lot of branding work right now, and so we're thinking about, well, what's the spirit, the Australian spirit that's sort of imbued in what we stand for as a brand and what we do in terms of our product. And I do think it's an Aussie thing to say, I want it to look good. I want it to be modern and fresh from a style point of view. But if I can't fit my stuff in it,
yeah.
Or I can't fit, like, I want to put a mandarin in here too. You know, like, isn't that funny with our bags, right? We do this what's in my bag on social media, which is like people pulling out all this stuff because it's like a Mary Poppins experience.
So it feels like a cat's bag. Yeah. Everything's in there.
Exactly. And so if people don't feel like they can use it regularly, then what's the freaking point?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Especially when you invest in a piece of leather that, you know, a lot of people are thinking, is this something I'm going to wear for 5 years and always have on my body? Well, then it has to be practical, because you wouldn't wear something that just, you know, tips over and dumpsters. Like, if it's not practical, then forget about it.
How does that translate then into overseas markets? So, you know, like let's say if you want people in America to buy it in New York or, you know, Paris or Italy or wherever.
I think the style side and those signifiers of what we stand for and how that sits next to other brands that are internationally out in the marketplace, it starts to be more important, because you have to be able to differentiate against, you know, a young French brand or an old French brand that's doing around our price point. I think there's a big price architecture, like women shopping for $4,000 bags are not necessarily saying they want to buy a $500 bag.
So how much is that bag, for example, retail, around about?
This would be about three, in the threes, yeah.
Thousands?
No, hundreds.
$300. Okay, yes. So like in terms of the market, because you made a really interesting point, one I've always been curious about. So someone's going to buy a Prada bag, and the Prada bag's, I don't know, $4,000 or something, can be more, but like let's say it's a $5,000 bag. Why is that person, do you know why that person's shopping for that and perhaps not shopping for Oran, or maybe they're going to have both? Would they buy both, and one becomes an everyday use, and the other, or a work everyday use, and the other one's just like, I'm gonna come out of shelf because I'm going to, you know, Rupert Murdoch's next wedding, and I'm gonna have the expensive handbag.
No, expensive handbags have just permeated society.
It's mental.
You know, it's mental.
Don't get it. Like, I really don't get it. Other than that, maybe it's going to go up in value. That's the only thing I understand.
Well, some of them do.
There's maybe a dollar to earn.
Some of them do. Not all of them, but some of them do. And there's a big resale market that you can see the circulation of that. At some point, it does also become pretty saturated, because between all the product they've created over the years and the resale markets that are now pretty robust and established, and the new stuff they're making, you know, it offers a lot more choice than you used to, which was just a new $5,000 bag or bust.
Because I look at Roxy Jasenko. I don't know if you know Roxy, but Roxy, she's a mate of mine. She's been on the show a few times. But, Roxy's always rocking like the most expensive bloody stuff ever. And she's smart and she's very clever, very canny. And I know Roxy would have a wardrobe. She could be getting sponsored to do this stuff, but she'd have a wardrobe full of these things, and it'd be, for her, it's like real estate, valuable. And she'd probably ever use it once.
Yeah.
And she probably got gloves on when she's touching it. And
That great Sex and the City episode when Carrie calculates how much she spent on her shoes.
I didn't see that episode. But
why she doesn't have a down payment for her
Malala, apartment. Manolo Blanco. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that it does become a hobby for some people, for sure, just like anything else.
But that's not the market you play in.
Well, we play in the handbag market. Yeah. So I actually think everything is fungible. I think the idea that someone really loves Gucci bags and they might buy one of ours is still possible.
Yeah.
It's just about what the value proposition is and how you position it. And maybe they don't buy a leather everyday shoulder bag. That is their Gucci bag or their Loewe bag, whatever it is. But they buy a basket bag from us that they take to the beach, or tote bag, or, you know, there's other parts of our portfolio that then could match back with. And that's the creativity of thinking about, really thinking about our customer, that we've also spent a lot of time in the business of, how do you think about fitting into the hearts and the minds and the wardrobes of women?
And the wallet.
And by the way, not just women, right? Anyone who's really interested in bags and what we do.
Yeah, totally.
And the wallet, exactly. Yeah. So that thinking, I think, leads you to understand you have different cohorts of customers that would associate themselves with Oran in different ways. But back to your question of why women are obsessed with handbags and really expensive ones, I mean, that's probably a whole conversation in itself. But there is something that those designer brands have been able to do, which is they sort of play at the Maslow's hierarchy towards the top, where it says something about who I am as a person, my style, my values, that I then have associated with Prada versus Loewe versus Gucci, you know, the different things on offer. And as subtle as that may be, I do think that's, it's reached those levels because it's almost ubiquitous that, you know, at some point in your life, you're thinking about that amazing, very expensive bag that you want in your life. Like, why is that so widespread? It's got to be something fundamental and primal again in the fashion world.
And that takes me to my next question. So, what have you learned about fashion?
Where do I start?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, Oran's, to me, is a really interesting case study of, in terms of, as just as an investment banking point of view, in terms of what Vickers has done. It's similar to those other brands I mentioned, those other iconic Australian brands. And, you know, he's gone out and brought in an expert, like, not an expert in fashion, but an expert in analytics and how do you operate a business. In the fashion of yourself, and I presume they're doing well, because I am actually seeing Oran a bit more, like more so than I've ever seen it before. Not that I'm not involved in that part of the world, but I do see the Oran, and I often think of it fondly because I know one of the boys
and your mom and your mom
and my mom, of course, yeah. And I go right back to that, and lo and behold, here you are today telling me about it, and you've sort of brought me right back into it, and hopefully, and in the audience who listens to this, they'll come back into it as well. But what is it telling you? What does that tell you about the importance, the fundamental importance of fashion, as opposed to it being a flippant, stupid, irrelevant
thing? Superficial.
I mean, which is sort of like hard-nosed people like you were before, and yes, I usually am. And I'm a bloke, so I probably think of it that way. What does it tell you about the importance of fashion, the fundamental importance of fashion? And I don't mean trending fashion. I mean fashion.
Yeah, fashion in the broader sense.
Hmm.
I honestly, where do I start? I've learned so much respect for what we do and the magic of it. As I
before, you
about.
Probably didn't respect it that much.
I honestly, I didn't. I did think it was a bit frivolous, yeah, and yeah, fashion, and you know, influencers and that whole space. Yeah, yeah. It just didn't feel very serious to me, and I was a very serious person.
Yeah.
So I was like, how does this work, and why will I care about it? But I do. I think there's real beauty in the process of what we do and how we create things that I definitely appreciate and I've learned a lot about. And that actually does make the world tick. I mean, whether it be in architecture or, you know, in interior space or product, there's so much design around us that does bring people joy subconsciously and consciously. And I think that's a real richness in life that without it be sort of lost.
Is there something about enduring beauty for you? It's things that endure. I mean, historically, that is the case.
What I've really learned is an appreciation for great brands. So I step away from your question, which is really about fashion, and it's actually about what a great brands persist the test of time and all the, like you said, ups and downs and trials and tribulations that naturally happen over 85 years. What is it about great brands that, you know, we have the ability to continue to build on? Because if we just define ourselves as fashion, I think it's actually pretty limiting. I mean, where all the things you described and that emotive side of what Orton stands for becomes a platform to do really cool things if we can articulate what that platform is. And so I'm not saying that we're going to all of a sudden not be in the core business that we are in. We'll always be in that. But what else can we do to have an impact in people's world and in their lives? And stand for something that then resonates for what they stand for as people. So great brand building and really thinking deeply about that is a whole territory that I've delved into that in my McKinsey life, I sort of understood, yeah, Apple's a great brand and Nike in reverence to them, but really kind of digging underneath how you get there has been a fascinating journey.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, when it comes to great brands, a little bit of survivability, admiration of survivability for me. Like I admire the survivability of something like Orton. Like it has this, there's something underpinning it that if it's properly managed, it'll always survive. And whether it's COVID or not COVID, and I mean survive at its level. So I don't mean just survive.
Yeah.
And I don't mean survive financially.
Yeah.
Yeah. It will do well because it has something fundamental about it that people just love.
Yeah.
And there's a relevance associated with it. And it must be quite a fascinating process for someone like you or someone with your background to go through. Like it's
But they don't always survive.
No, no.
That's an interesting point.
But like it never failed either.
I mean, it could have been the case that, you know, Will bought it and not with the right moves. And
yeah,
the
but
mindset.
Will bought it. That's the whole point. It survived because it had that survivability.
He
Will recognized
that
it. Yeah, and he said, this thing can survive.
And
I just
then he made a couple
right.
key decisions
yeah,
about
yeah.
what he, you know, at a very high level, again, not as an operator, but at a high level about reviving the relevance of the product and making that look good again and turn heads and then bringing that commercial sense to the business and the scalability of it. Like he sort of then, you know, pulled those levers. And so, yes, that's true.
Had bones, good bones.
But if you don't take care of things and actually evolve with time. I mean, I think one of the things I realize now, especially I was thinking about how young people, their reverence for brands and what they expect from brands is just different than what people of my generation or even before me expected from brands. It's a bit more transactional. Like if you give me a great thing, then, you know, maybe I'll say I love you. But to have a young person say they really love a brand and they're loyal to it, you've got to hit a higher bar. And so if we don't evolve as a brand and meet that demand, we also then could in fact die, right? Like we could in fact be this great brand that had a 90-year run and that's it.
So I need to ask you this.
About listening.
I need to ask you this then. Really important question. What keeps you awake at night?
Am I spending enough time with my family?
I meant in relation to Auden.
But I honestly answered. I mean, I'm always juggling that demand of where I'm investing my capacity, my time, as I think a lot of people who are really busy with their careers and work are.
But you can be in love with your job as well as your family. I think they can coexist.
Absolutely. They can coexist. I think to have balance, though, you've got to be proactive. Like, you actually really have to think about it.
Yeah.
Because things can get askew. I mean, I was 36 and single and, you know, loving my job at McKinsey, but that was leading me down a path that I think when I was 40, I might not have chosen that for myself. So it's just about, you know, being aware of where you're spending your time. What keeps me awake about Auriton?
In terms of brand or survivability or relevance, do you ever wake up and think, oh, my God, we've got to do this? What worries you?
Two things. One is that idea of brand and brand heat. I mean, fashion is a fickle place also. So back to the, like,
what's the
frivolous side of it. Like, you could be hot one day and not very not hot.
Like restaurants.
Like restaurants. Yeah. It's similar to hospitality in a lot of ways. And for me, it's like, how do we have enough of the metabolic rate in the business? And really that's about content generation. I mean, content generation is a massive wheel in our industry that you have to be putting relevant content out at a pace that just keeps you top of mind, or else you just fall into the background. And so there is something about maintaining brand heat, which isn't an analytical exercise.
Mm.
It's just this, there's a bit of magic around it. And so putting enough time and energy and that X factor in the way we run our business is a lot of what keeps me up. It's like, do we have that right? And the second thing is people. It's been my biggest learning journey as an operator, as a human being, has been, how do I change the way I spend my time, where I get my enjoyment? Because I got my enjoyment from problem solving. I love problem solving. I can get up on a whiteboard and talk about anything and break it down in a structure and think about the analytics we're going to do. Like, I love that. And when I came in, I did a lot of that. And so figuring out how to now use my time to motivate people, inspire people, give them a reason to be part of Auriton that goes beyond the paycheck is something that keeps me up at night. Am I doing enough of it? Am I inspirational enough? You know, am I actually bringing people along?
Well, I don't know what your people think, but given that you were a little bit nervous when you first came in here, I think you opened up the shoulders pretty good, and use an Australian phrase. And I would imagine if your people listen to this, the conversation, I don't know about them, but for me, one thing is for sure, is that your passion for this brand, it's not frivolous, it's not fleeting, it's quite deep because you understand it. And I reckon if you speak this way to your people, or at least they listen to this podcast, they'll come on the journey with it because you just did a brilliant job. You resold Auriton to me. Well done.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jenny.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's very good. Will, if you watch this, she's a gun. Good man.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love
and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.